participated in that have simply become American.
Maybe the ones who aren't. That's what she says. Kahopi.
Yeah,
the
well...
The ones that which aren't Hopi anymore.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as most... My activities on their behalf are... I don't claim to be a representative of theirs, because they don't believe in representation. They speak for themselves. I do what I do as an average citizen who is opposed to my own government's policy toward Native Americans. So it's a mammoth problem, and I'm not sure it's really solvable, but for my own conscience, I feel that it's my civic duty to do what I can to have their human rights protected.
You've done quite a bit. You work on this all alone? It's just your private thing?
Well, it's not my private thing. It's just that I guess I was the only one that was...
But I mean, do you work with a group or something?
No, I don't. I just work with the elders. And occasionally, you know, there are people around who have come to my assistance and helped me with travel expenses for them to come and...
But isn't there anything like the American Civil Liberties Union, or I don't know any...
Well, there are several things, but none of them...
Organizations. Aren't any of these helping the American Indian movement?
Well, I don't know. They could be, but I haven't worked through a movement. Uh-huh. I've just worked by myself.
They've never manifested themselves in as far as the Hopi?
Not as far as the Hopi. I wrote to them when I first started helping and asked them, and... they weren't really able to. I got the same story from them about this is an internal matter, and they couldn't, you know, the American Civil Liberties Union couldn't do something about the Hopi tribe, which I really didn't understand, but that was their position. So, basically, and I wrote to the NAACP, and they weren't really able to do anything either. I guess we're the wrong color. it's been amazing how many people weren't really... And the organizations weren't really able to do anything. But, you know, I've simply worked by myself with them. And we had an appointment. It took us 4 years to get our first appointment with the United Nations in New York. And we went there on September 30th, 1985. And there was a special conference planned by the liaison service. And the elders presented them with a little documentary that they had done on their prophecy, and answered questions about the prophecy. And then that afternoon we met with the Center for Human Rights, and that was where I learned that there is something called Procedure 1503, whereby an individual can file a complaint against a state. And that was where I learned about the Working Group on Indigenous Populations and the Subcommission on Prevention of Discrimination and Protection of Minorities. So it was at that point that we decided to write a complaint against the United States under Procedure 1503. So that took 2 years, and it was at that point that I included the relocation issue, because I felt it was a perfect example of the adverse effects of the trust policy on indigenous people or aboriginal communities.
Mm-hmm. Because your complaint in the original in its original form is larger than the relocation issue.
Oh, much, yes. It's against the trust policy on the grounds that the trust policy is a form of racial discrimination against aboriginal people. And the relocation issue was a current example of how when the trust policy is implemented, it works adversely to the preservation of and the protection of the traditional communities. Trust policy was theoretically established to protect Native Americans, to help them maintain their cultures as distinct ones. But in an implementation, it has proven to be a policy which gives the Secretary of the Interior paternalistic control over all of their decisions, and accomplishes exactly the opposite of what it was formulated to accomplish.
In a nutshell, trust policy means that the Interior Secretary decides what's good for the Indians.
Yes. Well, most tribal decisions have
to... The land doesn't belong to them.
No.
Tribal
decisions. It's one of the great public frauds that there is such a thing as Indian land, or that land belongs to a tribe, because all of the land is federal land. It's all part of the Department of the Interior. And it's simply used as a reservation, just like, you know, other places are used to protect the bald trees, eagle.
Yeah.
Yes. And anytime Congress wants to change it, it can. So that's the real situation.
Mm. No, you would have taught me that. I had no idea.
You should get the book, Rights of Indians and Tribes. It has the, I guess, the most comprehensive explanation of the trust policy and the trust responsibilities that I have seen in print, but even the ACLU in its chapter on the trust responsibilities never once questions the constitutionality of the trust policy. Now, to me, according to the Supreme Court, Native Americans have a unique status before the law, that of ward to a guardian, and there is no other race of people in the United States that has a unique status before the law. Unique status is contrary to what our Constitution is supposed to be about. We're all supposed to have equal status before the law. And there are some exemptions in the usual legislative procedures, which I think are subtle forms of racial discrimination. For example, all legislation is subject to the three branches of government, review by the three branches of government, except for legislation extinguishing land title. In this business of having absolute power to extinguish land title, the Supreme Court says such acts of Congress which do extinguish land title are not reviewable by any court. So they don't have the same protection of the three branches of government that the rest of us do. You know, there just are many little procedural things like this that nobody looks at when in effect they constitute a form of racial discrimination because they deny.
It's never been brought up in all not the to American my knowledge. Indian movement. They never brought this up at the Supreme Court. It seems extraordinary. That
I don't know. I'm not aware of some. It seemed extraordinary to me too. And when I've spoken to legislative aides and on the Senate Select Committee on Indian Affairs and the House Committee on Interior and Insular Affairs, various staff members have said to me that it is a completely novel approach to the trust policy, and to their knowledge, nobody on Capitol Hill has ever questioned the constitutionality of the trust policy, which I find thoroughly amazing.
Yes, but it seems to me that that would be a thing to try and get other Indian tribes to do.
Well, yes, not just this is.
I mean, now you're doing this United Nations thing, which is certainly excellent. But it would be interesting would be to try and get up to the Supreme Court, even in its actual form. At least they would be bothered to have.
Yes, well, definitely. But we have to remember, I am just one individual, one average citizen, and I do whatever I do at my own expense.
No, that's what I was saying. You know, if there is some kind of
the
organization of American Indians on a larger scale.
Well, people have varying.
It's their business too.
I don't think they've constitutionality of it. And the problem with opposing the trust policy is that it seems now that the United States is actually considering abolishing the trust policy, but that will mean that there would be technically no Indian lands or no lands used expressly for Indians, and that private ownership would then take over, and there would be no land where Indians could live free.
And the idea would be to give a certain amount of land to each Indian, or just not?
I don't know what it would be, but some tribes are afraid that opposition of the trust policy would mean that they would no longer have any free land. And so our position has been not that the trust policy should be abolished, because its original purpose was really quite noble, but that the way that it is interpreted and implemented should be revised, and that if there are some procedural aspects of the trust policy which, when implemented, affect a form of racial discrimination on them, then the policy should be amended. And the United Nations human rights experts, I think, should advise the United States on how to revise the trust policy so that it accomplishes what it was established to accomplish, rather than its opposite. But, of course, the United States really doesn't like this suggestion of mine, and would really, I think, be upset at the thought that they would need to be advised by the United Nations on this, because the United States presumes to be the leader of the world in human rights, and they don't take criticism lightly at all. But even if we were to lead the world in human rights is still does not mean that we're perfect. We all have clay feet, no matter what our relative positions are.
I saw the answer of the American representative, which was more to say, "Don't look at the at the straw in my." In my eye, when there's such big beams in other people's eyes.
Yes, but you see, their response to me has always been confirmed, in my mind, their own racial discrimination, because they always say, well, there are far more important human rights situations than this, and I feel all human rights situations are equal. Mm-hmm. And just because they are Indian human rights doesn't mean that they are less important than, say, the human rights of communists in Cuba. You know, I mean, I don't understand why our country is so much more preoccupied with the human rights of people in Cuba than they are with people within our own borders.
They've always been preoccupied.
Well, I think they're not genuinely interested
in
human rights. I think they are using
proportionally to the distance between them and Washington.
But I think they're using the human rights issue for political purposes.
No,
otherwise, they would be very sensitive to human rights situations in their own country and would want to address those first before any others.
Mm-hmm. Obviously. What is the situation, the last thing I want to ask you a little bit, where have you got with the United Nations now? I see there's a draft resolution,
which is relatively
a success, I think.
It's the third resolution, actually. We've gotten a unanimous decision every time that we've come. We filed a complaint under 1503, and then one Hopi elder, James Kuchangsi, and I came to Geneva in 1987, and really to kind of promote the complaint, but that's a confidential procedure. The working group on communications decided not to act on the complaint, which didn't surprise us. But still, the United States had to reply to that, and it was at that session of the subcommission that I extended an invitation to the subcommission from the traditional elders to appoint one or two members of the subcommission to attend and observe congressional hearings on legislation relevant to the relocation issue. And Madam Dias and Mr. Martinez co-sponsored the first draft decision doing that, and this decision was adopted unanimously. And Madam Dias and Mr. Simpson were appointed. But the United States relevant committees consistently refused to tell me when the hearings were being held, so that we were not able to bring any traditional Hopi to testify or to bring the two UN observers. I was even misled by the State Department, who wrote and told me that there were no hearings scheduled, and then they had a hearing, and it was reported in the New York Times. So we refiled the complaint under Procedure 1503 and added the new information, complete with the misleading correspondence from the State Department, and we came back to the United Nations in 1988, and this time we invited a Navajo elder to come with us. And it was in 1988 that the subcommission again introduced another draft decision, reaffirming the original decision, but adding the sentence that the two people appointed should prepare a summary report, which meant that they could come to the United States to gather information on this report, whether or not they came to hearings. And so at this point, the American expert, Mr. Carey, suddenly became terribly interested and got himself appointed as the second person. My feeling about his interest in this whole situation was that it was not motivated by concern for the human rights of the people involved, but much more so by concern for the image of the United States and having some control over what was going into the report. And I think my intuition or my feeling about his interest was confirmed by his methodology, because when he went out to Arizona, he wrote to everyone except the elders who invited the subcommission and wasn't planning even to go and see them. It was only because the United Nations told me that he was going that we knew he was going to Arizona. And they asked me to call him, which I did, and at that point he had someone completely unrelated to this project planning the schedule, and they had pretty much booked up all of his time. So it was only at great reluctance on his part and strong insistence on my part, I flew out there when he was there, that he actually met with the elders who invited the subcommission. I had to remind him out there that if it hadn't been for the traditional Hopi, he would have no mandate and no business out there, and I thought it was extremely rude of him to not even contact them.
Just incredible.
Yes. I didn't appreciate the fact that he was dishonest to the United Nations and told them that he wrote to me as well as everyone else, because he did not.
Hmm.
So I just feel that his purpose out there was to reiterate the United States position. So then,
fortunately, it was Mrs. Dias who was with him, or?
No, she wasn't with him. She came separately. He didn't even tell her that he was going. We found out that he was going during the commission. And so Madam Dias came to Washington and observed a House Committee Appropriations hearing and met with several congressional aides and with Congressman Bates and Senator McCain. Congressman Bates introduced into the House of Representatives moratorium legislation. It's an identical piece of legislation to one introduced in the Senate by Senator Cranston earlier. Senator Cranston has authored the bill and introduced it three times in the Senate, and fortunately now Congressman Bates has done the same thing in the House. So fortunately, Madam Dias's report at least was balanced. She went to great pains to get accurate information from people in the United States government and also from the Hopi and the Navajo elders and from representatives of the two tribal councils. So her report was balanced. And she recommends the moratorium legislation, which pleases us because I feel that a country as great as the United States should do everything in its power to protect the human rights of the people involved. And I don't think an 18-month delay on the completion of relocation is an unreasonable request for the protection of their human rights.
So Senator Cranston, that is,
yes,
that
legislation
is a moratorium.
Yes, in the Senate it's Senate Bill 481, and in the House it's House of Representatives Bill 1235. The bill calls for an 18-month moratorium on relocation and the establishment of an advisory commission, which would include
the elders,
traditionals, as well as tribal council members from both sides, and also human rights experts, social science experts, who would be able to really look into the human rights aspects of relocation and not just the mineral rights.
Who would try to, and
they would have 18 months.
Who would try to make an agreement that could avoid relocation?
Well, they would be an advisory commission, and the legislation calls for them having a series of public hearings in a variety of locations to give the maximum number of people affected opportunity to be heard.
Mm-hmm.
One of the traditionals' complaints has been that they're never told of the congressional hearings. They have no opportunity to testify. There are never any congressional hearings out on the reservation where most of the people would have an opportunity to be heard.
The only way is to go back, go back to the way he had given us, see? Because from the life that the indigenous people are living, you know, it just as soon as a baby is born, you don't see father, son till 20 days. There's a lot of fasting between the mother and the child. And if it's your first time, you don't even go outdoors. So you can't come in contact with the Mother Earth and the Father Sun yet. And so they have to stay in. Your first time, you have to stay in with the baby. And your in-laws wait on you, you know, hands and foot.
Mm-hmm.
They feed you and all that till the 20th day. Then it's a big feast day. See, the baby's ready to come out and meet the Creator and the sun and all that. See, so the names are giving, and before the sunrise, he's taken out, and all the names are announced to the father, father, son, you know. And from there on, there are many other ways that you have to go through the formalities, you know. And if you should take him to the out on the field for the first time, you have to run, because there will be another something else that's going to challenge his life. So the mother runs with him. If they don't get caught, you know, then he's okay. So there are a lot of
things. The first time
like
they go
that.
Where they have to run.
Yeah,
when you go to the field.
Yeah,
you say.
when you first take him into the Mother Earth, see.
Mm-hmm.
Because, like I say, there's 20 days, you know, that he does have no contact with the outside world yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's still an infant. But then after that, you know, when this is done, when you are out, you know, he's a stranger. Well, I guess the mother or whoever, there's a challenge between the Mother Earth and the... the outside forces, that's what it is, that they have to run, you know. And then if they're saved, they'll go over the line. That's it. So, you know, we have to remember all these things way back. But nowadays, these young matrons, I mean, you know, the girls that are bringing in, what do you call, the breast babies, you know, because there are a lot of breast babies. I heard that too through the African. I didn't know that African people had breast babies too. See, but that's what we're talking
breast
about.
Breast babies, what? Babies?
That are born, you know.
Out of marriage.
Yeah.
By accident.
Yeah, so,
mm-hmm.
So they were called the breast babies too, and
mm-hmm.
Well, we had a lot of those.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of those, and so now
intermarriage with other peoples, whites or Navajos.
Yeah, all different
or,
clans.
Or among the Hopis.
Because during the war, see, that's where they got mixed up, you know, with the soldiers around here.
There were lots of soldiers.
Because Hopi children are everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So they take them to every school. So that's where they come in contact with the soldiers. You know, we go out to work.
Mm-hmm.
During our school days, we go outing, you know, to make our money. So that's how they got into trouble. Well, if you're that kind, you know. And anyway, now those are the kind that had brought in the, they don't go through the formalities at all. See, maybe they'll go into fasting with their child, maybe a week.
Mm-hmm.
Then they're ready to take salt and things again, you know. But all that during 20 days fast, all that is limited. That, to me, is what made it perfect. You know, the children were perfect then.
Mm-hmm.
See, they were not bad children because they have to go, you know, from birth on up to that 20th day, the way all this is going through the baby's mind and a woman's, you know, you really do get the experience of what you're going through for the first time, you know, and you must always have to remember what they teach you, because there are a lot of ways that your in-law will take care of you, and she will do certain, you know, things that will help dry you up and all that, see? So they don't do that anymore.
Are these customs, are they still, do some people live this way? Do some people have their children this way now, or very few?
For a while it had entirely stopped. Because now the young matrons, I mean, and the girls and the young matrons wants to have it in the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So it stopped, but now they realize that their own method, their own way is much better. See? So a lot of them would rather go through a natural way than to be, you know, taking all these medicines. And I believe in this because, in a way back, I have seen a different kind of life. And now today's life, you know. Yeah, you can experiment with whichever, you know, life that's going on. We got what we wanted because the Creator is always willing to give you whatever you want. You know, if you want that kind of life, you can have it. But that materialistic life is not an everlasting one. It's the spiritual way of life is the one that's everlasting, see? So that is why the Hopis chose to be spiritual, you know, work with the spirit. And all those commands and prophecies that he gave them to live by. See, those things have not come out in this matter yet. And they will have to if the sub-commission go on ahead. So I'm glad that they have chose to go on, because this is all gonna, you know, come. It has to come off. Why we are here on Earth, you know, we are all here for purpose, and we have to straighten out our way. Creator's way is always, you know. They are perfect, but we're the ones. It's the human race that got out of hand. So we need to be straightened out. And we are going to be punished terribly, you know, for our mistake. That is toward last. So there are three left. There are still three left to be fulfilled. I don't know when. It's... As I watch close, we are now coming into this, we are in the gossiping state. When we are gossiping about just most anything and not paying attention to what we're doing, that's when something is going to strike us. See?
Mm-hmm.
We have gone through to the Second World War already. See, that's been in...
That was prophecy.
Yeah, that was in the prophecy. So the Third World War is coming up. And it may come off right there on the reservation.
Another war?
Yeah, the Third World War. It may start out on our own Hopi reservation. So we have to watch very careful, and you know, yeah. Well, but then that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
See, because we're still going forth. So whatever happened here, you know, it's okay. They made a mistake. They made a mistake because we were the ones that have asked them to come with us here. See. The Hopi, the Navajo was not invited,
mm-hmm.
but somebody else said, you know, that the Navajo should come in order to be strong. So they said, well, and you know those kind of type, you know, whoever that person is, that if they want certain type, they just insist. Well, I hope they learned their lesson, because we said, well, although we have made the friends with them, you have to be on your lookout with them. They're very tricky. But since we had become brothers and sisters again, you know, we have to look out for them too. But then the Hopi always wait. Let them get caught in their own web. This is it, see? That's why they're keeping still. Because all of us have that same privilege, you know? We can be foaming at the mouth, and if you don't look out, you're caught in your own web. Huh? The spider will catch you. So that's the way, that's why we're kind of waiting on them. They have to come to us. After all, they made the treaty with the Hopis just like any other nation did.
Who's the Navajo?
Navajos. When they couldn't lick the Hopis, they had made treaty. And they haven't carried out not one order. See? They haven't carried out their duty. Because when Kit Carson was going to kill them all off, it was the Hopis who saved them for reason. That's when they became a dog. I mean, that's when they became our watchdog.
The Navajo.
Navajos are our watchdog.
Assume the relocation issue, as I understand it, it all concerns this land that was common to be used commonly by Hopi and the Navajo peoples?
Well, initially, the land in question was actually Hopi land.
Yes.
But when Kit Carson was rounding up the Navajo for the long walk, some of them escaped and came around from the side of Big Mountain where they used to be, around to the other side of Big Mountain that was exclusively used by the Hopi. They escaped Kit Carson. And so these people...
That was when Kit Carson, that was...
back in
the
1800s, yeah.
Yeah,
the Long Walk
century.
Was 1868, and so it was around that time. Mm-hmm. And, but those lands were the
more
furthest...
attempted genocide in the Navajos, or was more of...
Could be. I try to stay away from the word genocide,
yeah.
Because it's one of those words that people turn their brain off when they hear,
yeah.
Because they... So... as I understand the history, and as the history is outlined in the introductory statements on Senator Cranston's moratorium legislation, some of these Navajo escaped Kit Carson and came around to the Hopi side of Big Mountain. But because those lands were like the furthest away from the Hopi villages that used them, they worked out an arrangement because the Navajo were nomadic and
mm-hmm.
roamed around the area with their sheep, and it was a very symbiotic relationship in many ways because the sheep kept the weeds down and kept the soil fertilized, and the Navajo would come to Haute Villa and perhaps other villages, but I think mostly Haute Villa, and give them mutton in exchange for the use of the land, and the Hopi would use the mutton in their kachina ceremonies, and it worked out relatively well. I'm
mm-hmm.
sure there may have been some arguments, but there are very few places in the world where neighbors don't sometimes squabble. That's
mm-hmm.
not an excuse for moving 10,000 people out of the way. You know, the traditional elders have always, Hopi elders have always told me that there never was any conflict between the Hopi people and the Navajo people. This is just something that the United States has fabricated with the cooperation of both tribal councils to facilitate the mining, as, you know, to justify
mm-hmm.
the removal of all those people. But
so that's what I wanted to ask with one of the main questions. I understood it from the statements, also even the some literature that I was given here, the congressional investigation recognizes that it has been accused that this was all
yes.
something which was
yes.
constituted to favor the mining interest. But in what
right.
way does the fact of taking the Navajo off this land and giving it back to the Hopi In what way does that facilitate the mining activity?
Well, giving it back to the Hopi doesn't facilitate anything. I should have told you back when I was talking about Kit Carson that after this happened and this band of Navajo escaped Kit Carson and came around to the other side of Big Mountain, there was, by executive order, the declaration that this strip of land, it's like a ring of land in between the two reservations, was declared a joint use
right.
area for any such Indian as the Secretary of the Interior would care
yes,
to
right,
place
yeah.
there. And so it was at the time of Kit Carson that it was declared a joint use area. And now this business of saying that the United States is giving this land back to the Hopi is a kind of semantic shell game, because technically, by United States law, there is no such thing as Indian land. It is all federal land, and the reservations are still federal land and are only used for one tribe or another so long as Congress deems it to be used in that manner. But anytime Congress wants to use the land in some other manner, they have, according to the Supreme Court, absolute power to extinguish all Indian land title at any time, in any manner, without their consent. So
Congress has that right.
Congress has the absolute power to extinguish all
Indian... And that is still recognized.
Yes. There is a book published by the American Civil Liberties Union called Rights of Indians and Tribes. It was written by Stephen L. Pivar, who is the director of the ACLU in Denver, Colorado. And it's an excellent book. It's the only place that I've been able to find any kind of comprehensive explanation of the United States Trust Doctrine, which is our national policy for Native Americans. And it was in this book that I found the quote from a Supreme Court decision saying that Congress has absolute power to do this. And so for the United States government to say that it is moving 10,000 Navajo out of a place that they made into a joint use area so that they can give the land back to the Hopi people is a semantic shell game. That's the only thing way I can think to describe it, because it's all federal land.
Mm-hmm.
And they are just changing the use. Now, it doesn't facilitates the mining interests to use this as an excuse for moving the people out of the way. It doesn't really matter who the land belongs to. It all belongs to the federal government.
Because the land has to be, you can't have people on it in order to mine it. They're going to strip mine or what?
Well, yes, I think so. But you can't commercially develop it, whether it's all mining or any kind of industrialization. If you have Aboriginal people kind of roaming around in these large areas of land, that's not, according to the Department of Interior and Bureau of Land Management, very profitable use of the land. And it's just incidental that a whole traditional culture is being disrupted by the movement of that many people and the commercialization of that large an area of land.
And does the federal government or the people want to develop the mining, they admit that this land will not be used by the Hopi to...
No, they don't admit it. They always usually repeat some kind of gibberish about how the Hopi have this sacred spiritual attachment to the earth as though they were going to continue to use it in that way. The traditional Hopi tell me that the land being theoretically given back to them is not going to be used by the traditional people in a traditional way. It is simply going to be used by American mining companies.
With the assent of the tribal council?
Yes, the tribal councils have worked in cooperation with the United States government and American businesses. And the problem with the mining is that, according to the United States trust policy, the Secretary of the Interior has numerous rights and approval procedures that give him kind of paternalistic control over tribal decisions and virtual veto power over most tribal decisions. For example, an Indian tribe cannot freely choose its own attorney. They have to obtain the approval of the Secretary of the Interior for their choice of attorney. The Secretary of the Interior also determines how how much the tribe will be paid for the minerals extracted from their reservation lands. And in the case of the Hopi Navajo with Peabody Coal, the Secretary of the Interior didn't just approve of the Hopi tribe's choice of attorney, he virtually assigned them an attorney, John Boyden, who was a former U.S. attorney and who was also representing Peabody Coal Company.
So he was representing both sides?
Yes. Oh, well, the Hopi tribe didn't even ask for an attorney to begin with. And so they were assigned an attorney through some kind of deal with a handful of individuals. They reconstituted the Hopi Tribal Council with less than 15% of the tribe participating in the election. And
this was in the 30s.
In the 50s. Well, when the Indian Reorganization Act was passed in 1936, every Indian tribe virtually had to have a tribal council and a constitution. But that original tribal council just simply never functioned from lack of participation. But it was in the 50s that they were assigned John Boyden, and he did what they call reconstituted the Hopi Tribal Council. And at the same time that he was representing the Hopi tribe and Peabody Coal, who has a mine in the area, he filed a lands claim settlement thing for them, which they never wanted. And so the Hopi tribe has never accepted, I think it's $5 million that is sitting someplace in exchange for these lands, because they never really wanted a claim settlement. They wanted to retain the land.
Claim settlement on the mining?
On the land where the mine is, in the joint use area. Mm-hmm. So
so this is kind of
in any case, it's all still semantics, because Secretary of the Interior negotiating the contract for the coal, in the case of the joint use area and Peabody Coal Company, the tribes are paid 25 cents a ton for the coal, and it's divided between two tribes, and that price is far below market
value. It must be pretty much below.
It's very much below. Before John L. Lewis died, he managed to get legislation enacted that gives the coal miners union a 40-cent royalty on every ton of coal mined. And so at that time, it had to be over 40 cents at least. So you see, it's hard for me to imagine any mining being in the interest of the people, because they are getting paid far below. And even the silly 25 cents is not directly given to the tribes. It's kept in trust accounts in Washington, and it cannot be spent without the approval of the Secretary of the Interior. So it's really a word game, and it's really a method of providing American companies almost free natural resources. And then, in the case of the coal being mined by Peabody Coal, the Department of the Interior buys the energy that is produced from the coal back from Peabody Coal. So there is a really strenuous conflict of interest here.
Mm-hmm.
And that is real motivation.
If the government can give the coal cheap enough to Peabody Coal, they can hope to be buying it back from Peabody Coal for not too much money.
Exactly. Exactly. You see, if the mine belonged to the tribe, and if the tribe negotiated its own contracts to sell the coal at market value, and if the mine controlled the rate at which the minerals were being extracted and the method, then one could argue that the more progressive members of the tribe are benefiting by this. But given the fact that the mines don't belong to the people, and they are being paid far below market value, and have no control over the rate at which the minerals are extracted or the method, then it doesn't benefit anyone except the American businesses who are taking the coal out. And plus, they have to use so much water to slurry the coal to wherever they do, it really harms the traditional way of life. They pray for rain. They, according to their religion, they don't irrigate. And so when you take that much water out of a desert, you really reduce the water table, and it makes it impossible for them to continue to raise their corn out in the desert praying for rain with their kachina ceremonies. It's just, the two activities are antithetical. Mm-hmm. You cannot have people living aboriginally where there is great industry. It's mm-hmm. And so you
now
know
I read in one, I went through the Hopi country and 10 years ago, a little bit more, mm-hmm. and at the time I found some literature of the Hopi traditional side of things, which said that there was already was a problem of pumping, which had reduced the water table. And that there were places where they couldn't get their crops anymore because
right.
the great snake underneath the earth had was mad and.
That's
was
right.
No longer giving any water because they had been pumping at him.
Yes, that's right. So my issue with the United Nations is they have a working group on indigenous populations, and they have a subcommission for prevention of discrimination and protection of minorities. And it seems to me that indigenous populations need to be looked at globally rather than as people living within internal states, because you know each country that you discuss the indigenous peoples, it becomes an internal matter, and every administering state has its own way of dealing with its indigenous peoples. But there has to be some kind of global consciousness to protect the few primitive societies that remain on the earth. And it seems to me that the United Nations and various other countries cooperate to protect other endangered species. We protect animals, we protect plants, we protect their habitats, but we do not do the same for humans living in the wild. Essentially, that's what Aboriginal communities are. They are not in the modern world, and they don't have political nations the way westernized countries do. They simply have their religion and their very natural traditional values and patterns, and the crush of technological society is denying them their right to live in a primitive fashion, which seems to me to be one of their basic human rights. And I think it's a form of racial discrimination against primitive peoples to deny them the right to remain primitive if that's what they want.
And it seems to me that now there is for instance, there's a lot of at least a lot of talk about trying to force the Brazilians, for instance, to respect a little bit more the indigenous populations in Amazonia. Why shouldn't the Americans protect a little bit their own indigenous populations? I wanted to ask you, too, compared to, for instance, the situation of other Indians in the United States, I think it's in Oklahoma and Texas. It seems to there have been similar situations where there was oil under Indian land. Have they been built in the same fashion, or
I can't imagine that there would be any exceptions. I really am most familiar with the tradition of Hopi. More recent, because I've worked with them for 9 years, and it's really only been since 1986 that I began to work with the Navajo, too, because their problem touched upon the traditional Hopi's problem. Mm-hmm. The traditional Hopi would prefer to continue to share that land with the traditional Navajo living in an Indian way than to have the area mined. And so I included the relocation issue in our complaint against the United Nations, because against the United States with the Commission for Human Rights. And in the last couple of years, of course, since I've been coming here, I've been meeting other Native Americans from other parts of the country, and I've met with some Lakota elders from South Dakota who came to my home to ask me if I would take them to Geneva too. And although I don't know the details of their situation as well as I know the Hopi and the Navajo, it sounds like they have the same problem. They are unhappy that their tribal council is leasing away their land in the Black Hills, and you know that all these outside interests are affecting their ability to remain Indian. You see, what's happening, the problem is that people think of Indians as poor people, and the usual conditioned way of trying to help them is to try to westernize
modernize them,
and that's everyone's idea of equality, to give them a Western education, to get them into a moneyed economy, and all these other modern things, bring them running water and electricity. That's a natural reaction. Even when we first came to the United Nations, they thought of this as the same way they think of third world countries, where, you know, you need development. And what they need is exactly the opposite. What they need is someone to help protect that some tribes would, by preference, prefer not to have running water and electricity and modern things. It's like a whole new idea to people, that some want to just remain aboriginal and primitive, and they don't consider it better to have all these modern conveniences. So that's been a major problem in trying to figure out how to help them, because everyone has this conditioned reaction to immediately want to modernize them as a way of making them equal and better.
Yes, that brings up a question I wanted to ask you, because obviously part of the problem, as far as I can make out from speaking with Carolyn, is that there's a part of the Hopi, of the Hopi people, or part Hopis, or who have been more or less assimilated, or more or less attempted by white man's ways or money or jobs or whatever. And how do you evaluate the situation? What kind of support does the tribal council have in the Hopi community?
Well, it's a little bit difficult to get totally accurate statistics, but even in this most recent election of the tribal council chairman, less than 25% of the people participated in the election. The United States filed a formal written reply to our complaint at this session of the subcommission, and in it they gave the election statistics. I don't have the papers right here with me, but according to the United States' own written reply, there are over 5,000 people in the Hopi tribe. Slightly more than 1,000 of them participated in the last election. Now, what the United States claims is that even though over 3,000 of the 5,000 didn't participate in the election, they still consider that the tribal council represents a majority of the tribe, because they say a lot of Hopi don't live on the reservation anymore and don't participate in the election for that reason. But they have no way of substantiating that, and it is traditional for Hopi to boycott whatever they don't approve of. And so I really don't feel that their argument that the tribal council represents a majority of the Hopi is sustainable by the facts, because they have no way of knowing what the motives were of the 3,000 plus Hopi who didn't participate in the election. So since 1906, the United States has been systematically removing Indian children, Hopi in particular, from their homes and families and taking them away to boarding schools. Carolyn was taken away at 8 years old and kept for 10 years in a boarding school. And it's only as recently as 1986 that there was a high school built on the Hopi reservation. A little bit longer ago than that, I don't know the exact date, but I would say 15, maybe 20 years ago, there was an elementary school built in Haute Villa. So the children were not taken away at such an early age after that point. But still, 20 years ago is fairly recent for people to be taken away from their families, put in boarding schools in another state, forbidden to speak their own language, totally removed from their cultural context. And
this went on until, in fact, in the high school level,
until 1986. You see, one of the phenomenons that I think is a very grim reality is the fact that Indian children, according to United States Public Health Service statistics, Indian children have the highest incidence of suicide of any group in the country. And this is a global phenomenon as well. Indigenous children around the world have the highest rate of suicide. And I think it's because of the mandatory Western education that is imposed on primitive peoples. And I think they
Mind
they well, it creates a deep conflict. Because when you're taken away and put in a boarding school and, you know, introduced to electricity and showers and television and modern ways, it's very difficult to go back. And, you know, they're not given the kind of education that really qualifies them to compete successfully in the white world. Essentially, what they come home with is a sense of being inferior because they're Indians.
Yes.
And looking upon their own culture and their own traditions as inferior.
Mm-hmm.
And this creates a deep psychological conflict, because if they are to be realistic and look at the world, the only way they're really going to succeed is to become Western. But that means they have to betray their grandparents, and they have to betray who they really are.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is resort to alcohol and drugs and suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, this is really alarming. I don't know how indigenous populations are going to continue to exist if their young people kill themselves at a higher rate than any other group. Then they soon won't be here. And to me, that qualifies them as endangered species, an endangered race. I don't know how the red man in the United States is going to continue as a separate race, because they're simply not permitted to live in a red man's way. I mean, they may still be some individuals who are Indians and red, but they can't live the way their race has always lived because of this crush of technology all around them and our insistence at assimilating them forcibly. So that's one of my main purposes for helping the Hopi and coming to Geneva, because I feel that at least here there are people who are sensitive to that and who are genuinely like to try to find a solution. But it is a massive problem, because all of the countries who have indigenous populations within their political borders are extremely sensitive and want to relate to this as an internal matter and don't want anyone really helping them, because they are living on some major pieces of land with natural resources. It's unfortunate that everyone is so selfish about it and, you know, wouldn't find some kind of compromise way, like having the resources belong to the tribes and have them do a certain amount of economic development, but not so much that it totally eliminates any possibility for the traditional members to remain living in a traditional way.
I didn't know very much about it, but from what I've heard, in Australia, the Aborigines have acquired a certain number of rights. At least the mineral companies have to go into rather complex negotiations with the tribes themselves. I don't know if you know about that.
I don't know. I really have focused most of my attention on the Hopi,
mm-hmm.
and that really takes up all of my time.
I think it compares quite favorably mm-hmm. With the situation of
mm-hmm.
at least of the Hopi, the American Indians, because I know there's been a book written about it lately. It's a very complicated business, because they have they're nomadic and they have these long
mm-hmm.
treks which they go on, which correspond to the migrations of their ancestor,
mm-hmm.
Of their fetish ancestors across the deserts, you know,
mm-hmm.
and so that is their land.
Yeah.
So with the companies have to, they suddenly and some of these, so some of their territories are 2,000 kilometers long and 10 yards wide, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So then the companies have to kind of negotiate. So obviously they must have had some kind of recognition at a legal level.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Just lately, I think, the last few years.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know
there's
that
a movie made about it too. Didn't you see that movie?
The Last Wave?
Where the Green Ants Dream?
No. He thinks that being modern is better, and so everyone's efforts are to modernize them and develop them economically, which makes it impossible for them to remain Aboriginal.
Mm.
So what seems to me to be the most pressing thing to do...
Right, and to be different.
Yes.
It's the basic right that people don't...
Well, they're not allowed not to have a political structure. For instance, the Hopi, they just have their religion and their clan system and their priests and their elders. They don't have a political state, but they have to have one in order to relate to the United States government. All Indian tribes have to have one.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what would help indigenous populations the most is for people to begin to relate to them as endangered species and to begin to think about protecting their habitat regardless of how much resources there are in their area. There are resources in areas where the bald eagle is protected. The bald eagle in the United States gets his habitat better protected than Native Americans. I think it's a form of racial discrimination on the part of my government to have Native Americans in the Department of the Interior as though they were just a natural resource. And when I have addressed the Bureau of Human Rights about the human rights of the Hopi and the Navajo in this instance, they always refer me to the Bureau of Indian Affairs as though Indians are not also humans. Same thing with the Congressional Subcommittee on Human Rights and International Organizations. They're not interested in overseeing the human rights of the Native Americans because they do not consider that their responsibility. Native Americans are simply put in this other basket, which is the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Department of the Interior, and no one looks at their human rights. The only thing that the Department of the Interior considers are their mineral rights and the land use. That's it. They don't even have the same protection as other endangered species that also come under the care of the Department of the Interior. Now, I think that's a very peculiar thing. And to me, it just shows that the racial discrimination toward Native Americans is totally institutionalized, and that there is this institutionalized callousness to them as humans.
And what how do you interpret the position of the people who say of the 1,000 people who voted in this for the tribal council, the people in the or the tribal council themselves? Are they completely opportunistic, or are they?
They're completely opportunistic, but remember, they probably all were taken away from their families as children, and put in a Western school for 10 years and
convinced.
Taught to be Western. And you know, it's either become modern and survive in the real world, or you know, just be a poor Indian, because nobody values the traditional way of life. So I think it would be more accurate to just call them realistic rather than opportunistic. It's a fact of life that the world is being modernized, and that no one values primitive cultures and their traditions. Everyone looks at them as inferior because they are so basic. I think probably the